I've never really used one of these. Tell me, Mr. Bannon, what do you have to say about this?
It's an all-new, all-different podcast from Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Hey, listeners. This is part two of a two-part episode on American policy and the rise of China. We now join myself, Dan Nexon, and Rob Farley mid-conversation. So yeah, anyway, we've established, I mean, at the risk of repetition, we've established complacency and we've established that we weren't prepared for it, and we've established that a lot of the best academic, the focus on academia wasn't on questions of power transition, which doesn't say it wasn't there. There was a very robust power transition paradigm. There were people working on China. So Ian Johnston is working on Chinese socialization into international fora and that sort of thing. So it's not like we're completely missing the boat, but I think that it's fair to say that we're distracted at the policy and at the academic level from these kinds of questions that we're now wrestling us, but not completely distracted, because 10 years ago or so, you start to get the rise of discussion about rogue donors, and you start to get an increasing amount of work thinking about, hey, wait a minute, the Chinese, at that point it's also the Venezuelans and others, they're giving out economic aid. And they're flexing their muscles, and they don't seem to care about things like corruption or human rights or democratization. In some cases, they actually don't seem to like it very much, you know, like the kinds of conditionalities that the U.S. is putting on. You do see the formation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So you start to see some developments that kind of look like counter-hegemonic, counter-order, whatever you want to call it. You start to see some attention to the fact that that the U.S. liberal order might be facing some processes of erosion.
I wonder. I mean, there's also. I'm sure we'll get to this, right? But we at some point we could think about this too in terms of sort of Henry Farrell's approach to this, right? The sort of the end of the hypocrisy gap, where the United States was able to sort of take advantage of a huge hypocrisy gap for a long time, and this begins to wane in consequential ways during the period we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have the Great Recession.
Right. Question. I guess I know that this is going to be disruptive too, but from the IR perspective, and I think from the perspective of a lot of people who thought a lot about politics during the 2000s, the Iraq War is what sort of really is the timber that shudders against the gate of American hegemony, right? It's that this is the gong right here, which indicates that the Americanized, liberalized global order is not, in fact, all that it's made up to be. It's not as stable. It's not as good. And that it's possible to undertake counter-hegemonic activities. Do you think 15 or 20 years from now we're going to think that the Iraq War was, in fact, this very consequential disruptive event for the American internationalized order? Is it going to look more like 2008, 2009, right, that when things really sort of started to fall apart in ways that were not just something happening in Iraq, but that were devastating to the sort of major established economies of Western Europe and to a lesser extent in Asia, but that can be still set at the feet of the American international order?
Well, I'm not sure I followed you exactly, right? But you mean whether... Mm-hmm. But because I think that you're exactly right to emphasize that... You know, it's funny, because if you go back to the very beginning of the Great Recession, and you're going to take... I think, at least in my circles, there was a sense that if you were really cynical about power politics, this was going to look pretty good for the United States. Because the United States had the ability to deficit spend in a way that a lot of other countries don't. It had the dollar premium. And in fact, there was a rush back into U.S. dollars. So the U.S. has the ability to borrow at effectively negative interest rates. It has that market power. And has a system that, in the past, had looked pretty robust in the face of economic crises, right? It looked like the United States had figured out things about stabilization and things like that. And if you actually looked at the Chinese, you'd think, you know, big downturn in exports, that's going to be really bad for them, right? You don't have a diversified economy. You have a very export-dependent economy. And so what happens, though, is the Chinese engage in massive stimulus, which may have structural downsides for them, right, because they basically build lots of infrastructure that they probably don't need. But nonetheless, this doesn't work out that way. The Chinese economy turns out being to look more robust than we might have expected. And the U.S. political economy is so messed up that, if anything, the Great Recession makes things worse.
Right.
Which is to say that we lose the opportunity to, after the infrastructure spending we do in the American Recovery Act, we lose the ability to continue this process it looks like we could engage in of basically massive pump priming with a focus on developing infrastructure, human capital, other kinds of investment spending. Mm-hmm. And the reason I raise that is not just because I'm a partisan Democrat, and I think the Republicans have a lot to answer for in terms of privileging domestic partisan politics over long-term U.S. National security kinds of interests. Right. But I think this is actually a story that goes back to the Iraq War, right? I mean, you could even tell a story that says the Iraq War is in part responsible for why the Great Recession is so bad. This is the Thomas Oatley story,
right?
All this debt borrowing during the Iraq War, the ways in which we pursue stimulus through tax cuts and through low interest rates have certain kinds of effects on the global economy that make it much more vulnerable to the collapse of the U.S. housing market, and help to generate the dynamics that lead to the collapse of the housing market. So I think, you know, in a sense, what I'm trying to say here is that if we there's something very odd about this story, right? We focused on the story about how the United States doesn't take proactive measures to stem the rise of a potential peer competitor. Mm-hmm. The flip side of that is that if you look at the raw data, right? You look at the U.S. The sort of infrastructural advantages that the U.S. has globally that it built up during the second, you know, after the during the Cold War and in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Its central position in the in global finance. You look at its the fact that its nominal economy is still significantly larger than the Chinese, right? You look at these technological advantages that are the dividends of, you know, essentially Cold War era investment,
which may be waning, but still are an advantage.
But that's the point, right? Yeah. So you look at all these things, and you look at you look at the actual percent that the U.S. is spending on defense compared to states that are really engaged in high levels of militarized competition. It's not that high, right? Even though it seems quite bloated if you look at sort of, you know, a more conservative assessment of U.S. needs. So you look at all of these things. You look at the fact that during the Iraq War, the U.S. is not spending, moving to a total war footing, right? So the U.S. has a kind of a lot of latent military and economic capability that's just not exploited. And if you look at that story, if you think about all of that, the rise of China and the structural shift in the international economy is a big part of what's happening, right? It's a fundamental driver of the power transition. But if you flip that around and look at the U.S. domestic politics and you look at U.S. foreign policy and then you add in the Trump factor, the U.S. is not behaving in ways that make any sense for a country interested in maintaining its hegemony. Right, it's acting in ways that are incredibly self-destructive in terms of its infrastructure and domestic power base. On the foreign policy side, that's raising doubts about our alliance commitments. It's playing hardball with countries that would much rather be allied with the United States than to be contemplating potential security relations with China or Russia. And
it's embracing a certain degree of political weakness, right? You know, with sort of it's embracing the weaknesses of the American political system, right? Mm-hmm. Through things Russia and through other situations, right? No, that makes sense. I mean, are there any sort of examples that leap out to you, any historical examples that leap out to you about this kind of behavior from, you know, a struggling hegemon or a struggling major power that seem sort of at all to be parallel that you can think of?
It's hard. I mean, if I knew more about British...
Where domestic politics sort of overwhelm what should be a very competitive position.
There is this argument about the Eastern Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm, right.
right? That in the Eastern Roman Empire, the primary security threat is understood to be generals and other factions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this means that the Eastern Roman Empire really can't get its act together in the face of military challenges, because a successful general is more of a threat to the domestic political elites.
You know, I mean, this is analysis that also underwrites the entire Isaac Asimov's entire Foundation series,
right?
Too, right. So his interpretation of that.
And there's some interesting kind of side stories you can tell. So, you know, the period that I've done the most work on, which is the 16th, 17th century Europe. You know, I look at that period, and I think the story of the decline of Spanish hegemony is very much a story about domestic insurrection and revolt. They're essentially failures to manage the political system. So the Dutch Revolt, for example, so they're done in ultimately by uprisings, transnational religious movements that are activating cleavages within their empire. There's also the standard story, which, you know, there's a lot of debate over, that the Spanish drain the Castilian economy in order to finance their overseas adventurism. And they do that in part because they, at the end of the Communist Revolt, the Habsburgs make a bargain with the Spanish aristocracy that they won't really tax them. They'll only tax the non-nobility class. And there's a story that kind of crushes the most productive sectors of the Spanish economy. But in all those scenarios, right, you're talking about kind of existential military threats to the polity that are going on, whether or not they're of their own making. So the Spanish are fighting wars, right, all the time. And they're not fighting little wars, right? They're fighting wars against other great powers. The Eastern Romans are fighting wars where other countries are encroaching on their kind of core their territories. The United States isn't doing that. So the United States story looks particularly puzzling to me.
The U.S. is not fighting wars that should be economically consequential, except insofar as we can tell this story about the complex financial structures that undergird the U.S. economy and undergird the global economy that were disrupted in a lot of ways by Iraq too, right? So while still having sort of that story out there, that, you know, you have this very disruptive to the fiscal system, you're absolutely right that, you know, there is no way that the United States should not be able to completely eat an Iraq war and, you know, by Cold War standards, maintain sort of an economic, its economic place.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason why the United States should be worrying so much about other states closing the technological gap right now. The United States could be investing enormous sums in education, in the higher educational system. It could be investing enormous amounts of money in R&D, right? It could be doing these major initiatives. Sure, there'd be a lot of waste because a lot of those things don't pan out, but the whole strategy of those things is to throw a lot of money around and hope that some of them pan out. I mean, we could be doing the kinds of things that ultimately are the genesis of the internet, right? You know, Gore got mocked, but in fact it was ARPANET, and it was investments in computer sciences that built that created the foundations for the modern internet. It could be investing much more in biotechnology. It could be having that R&D not be so tightly focused within the military. It could be more generally engaged in civilian R&D. It's just not doing any of that stuff.
Right. The overall percentage of federal funding for R&D has dropped as a percentage almost continuously since the beginning of the Cold War. I mean, to create an inflection point here, and we'll see how far we can go with this, but let us say two things. One, and these are maybe the two conclusions we've arrived at. One, the United States failed to take any consequential steps to preclude China. All right. Two, the United States, as of right now, does not appear to be taking consequential steps, obvious potentially consequential steps, for even the shoring up its own hegemonic claims, right? You know, perhaps militarily in a sense, right? But certainly not technologically, not economically, in terms of the maintenance of U.S. infrastructure, the maintenance of sort of the greater financial structures of the U.S. economy, the maintenance of U.S. international reputation, right? I mean, we are not stopping them, and we do not appear to be shoring up our own position, right? So what does this tell us about, you know, what sort of, where does that leave us now in terms of thinking about, you know, things that the United States can do in order to maintain this international order that we have created, right, or that we have facilitated. You know, what do we do now that China is large, is going to continue to grow larger, and we don't appear to be internally balanced, able to internally balance against that?
Before we, I'm going to do one more interjection, though, because all those things we talked about, right, mm-hmm. the way in which the United States is destroying a lot of its capital endowments on the diplomatic side, on the economic side, right, is not taking mm-hmm. steps to shore them up or is actively eroding them. Mm-hmm. This is how a lot of the rest of the world perceives what's happening as well.
Right.
And that means you can have self-fulfilling prophecies.
Right.
So when,
right.
I don't
Absolutely.
Know what your experience is, when I go abroad and I talk to academics and I talk to policymakers, they all see the U.S. is in precipitous decline. They see the U.S. is in chaos and capable of getting its act together, and they see the Chinese very actively stepping up and trying to fill that gap. And that's not just on the side of, you know, sort of clear order building, the Asian Infrastructure Bank, which was, you know, under the Obama administration. The Obama administration really mm-hmm. bobbled that badly. It's not just in terms of the One Belt, One Road initiative, which I think is going to be generate, as you know, a lot of white elephants. But it's also, you know, the kinds of things that we're now starting to think about, you know, when we think about mostly in terms of Russia, right, sort of, but which the National Endowment of Democracies Project calls, you know, globalized authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sure. Chinese money flooding into Australian politics or New Zealand politics. It's Confucius Institutes, you know, building the infrastructure of what we tend to call soft power, right, which the mm-hmm. U.S. used right. to do but doesn't do anymore. It's making sure that they can keep an eye on Chinese students abroad, right? It's getting enmeshed in the politics of other countries in a way that the U.S. has sort of had been privileged to do it alone for some time.
Right.
In a So that, in a sense, that can be self-fulfilling, right? If you think the U.S. is in retreat, who do you go with? Not the power that's in retreat, right? Or do you think the U.S. is... But beyond that, those types of things are having... They're starting... We are kind of, I think, looking like we're in an inflection point. Those things are starting to have transformative potential. We're starting to see the traces of those transformations.
Right. And I mean, do you think that there's just a complete disjuncture between sort of how... I mean... For people who are not us, right, for those people out in the Midwest in rural communities who, took Make America Great Again seriously, right, there does seem, and not to get political about this on a political podcast, right, but I think you sort of opened the door to this, right, is that the perception within the U.S. political scene is entirely... From their point of view, entirely different, right? I mean, I think they take Make America Great seriously, right? And there's not this understanding that from this international perspective, we have turned from, you know, so maybe perhaps what was in the Obama administration, a slow, graceful decline or just a leveling off, to really precipitous drop.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that is that the story about U.S. global position being told in right-wing media, mm-hmm. right, is very flawed. Right. So, we know that frustration of, you know, how awful Obama was. And there are actually some ways in which Obama foreign policy did not work very well. Mm-hmm. So and that's going to be true of any foreign policy by any 8-year presidency. But, you know, let's not sugarcoat it. Obama made some very consequential mistakes in foreign policy. But the perception that, you know, the U.S. perceived was collapsing was really a domestic market issue. Right. It was really kind of in right-wing media that it was completely disconnected, as you say. And the idea that somehow Trump's restoring U.S. domestic prestige is completely disconnected from all of the objective indicators. But I think that if you push a little deeper, right, I mean, the biggest disservice of the globalist versus nationalist way of looking at the world is that... if you are somebody who wants an isolated America that's ethno-racially pure or whatever, that frame kind of makes sense, because mm-hmm. what you kind of want actually is a weak America, right? So the anti-interventionist, alt-right, quote-unquote alt-right types, there's a kind of consistency there, right? Mm-hmm. The U.S. should just make deals with other great powers and should stay at home and focus on being ethno-civilizationally pure, Okay, right. I can get that. But I think that's not the majority of viewpoint in even the conservative movement. The majority of the viewpoint is American leadership is a really good thing, and we want to be great again. That is, we want to be a powerful world power. The nostalgia is for the 60s and the 50s, the pre-Vietnam era, and then to some degree for the 80s. So if you look at it that way, globalism is not the opposite of nationalism. Globalism is what they call globalism is in many respects the mechanism for U.S. hegemony. And nationalism is how we screw that up in the way that they understand it.
Right, right. Or nationalism is the answer to sort of the failed or what could be perceived as a failed effort, as failed steps towards globalism, right, would be another way to phrase it, depending on ideological perspective, right? And it's hard for me to say, you know, how deep sort of that alt-right understanding of U.S. nationalism and U.S. power goes, just because, you know, whatever, I guess I live in Kentucky, but still, I don't sort of get many ideologically sophisticated arguments that this is a widespread view of what American power should look like, right? That it should be, you know, sort of this active retreat kind of situation. It's not widely held among even people who have that sort of that broader ideological predisposition.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to try to excavate a way of thinking that I don't think either of us fully grasp. And I think that, you know, clearly for a lot of people, their sense of whether the U.S. is great depends on their local economic circumstances or
right.
depends on sort of what you focus on. But when I talk about the perniciousness of globalism versus nationalism, I don't mean the idea that we should all be globalists the way that that Bannon talks about globalism. What I mean is that the ways and the policies that are associated with globalism, with the exception of with the caveat of certain things about trade policy, are really deeply self-interested American leadership dominance things, right? I mean, I've sort of ranted before about how the way that even the sort of multilateralist left talks about the Marshall Plan, right, is as if it was this, you know, big act of altruism, right?
And
that even peters over into some of the criticisms of One Belt, One Road is, oh, look at all the ways in which the Chinese are really doing self-interested stuff. Well, the Marshall Plan was primarily, you know, it was not altruistic.
Nope.
And it wasn't only not enlightenedly self-interested, it was deeply self-interested. The U.S., as you know, cracked open markets, right? And used it to ensure that people were buying U.S. goods and that corporations, that the Coca-Cola company could become a big player in Europe and things like that. So it was always deeply cynically self-interested in its implementation. And I think that to some degree that's been true of a lot of American liberal hegemony, or if not all of American liberal hegemony, even when we discount the stuff that you and I say, you know, is the part of the package we don't want, overthrowing democratically elected governments, supporting death squads, even the stuff that sort of looks good has always been deeply self-interested.
Right, which in some, I mean, I think some people would argue was why so much of it was so successful, right? Because you could wed, you were able to succeed. And this may be where sort of the PNAC people really have their greatest point, right? That the liberal international order is established from 1945 on, wedded together in inextricable ways American self-interest and an enlightened understanding of what global politics should look like, right? And it was able to wed those two together and use them to drive each other in synergistic ways, I guess are words that I'm trying to find for right now. And now two things are happening to that, which is, which you've identified and others, right, which is on the one side that this understanding of American hegemony and America's self-interest in the global international order is waning within the United States for reasons that are sort of hard to suss out, but are there, definitely. And second, that American self-interest, even were it sort of enthusiastically, if it remained enthusiastic and powerful within the United States, may not be enough to control that system any longer.
Right.
May not be enough to provide the rules and the laws that make that system operate.
And we have to be clear, because there is a secular shift going on in economic and military power in the world, right? You know, we don't know. There's a lot of we don't have a sense of whether China is going to wind up being, you know, four times the size of the U.S. economy, or it's going to max out at basically equivalent to the U.S., right? Mm-hmm. And there are outside scenarios where China does implode, right? Something catastrophic happens.
Right, but the
general shift has been towards East Asia. Right, and away from the United States and the North Atlantic core. Right, and nothing's going to permanently arrest that. In fact, from a global historical standpoint, the period of Western dominance is very unusual, and there are reasons to think that the natural center of gravity in the world is actually in the Eastern Pacific, because that's the way historically that it's generally been. So if we think about that, what that means is that the U.S. ability to manage its hegemonic position or to forge order-oriented bargains that are favorable to it, we should assume is in decline and has been in decline. Mm-hmm. So we should, if we project out the likely future scenarios, the ability of the U.S. to get what it wants globally is going to be diminishing over time. Mm-hmm. No matter, even if we arrest all of these trends, which creates a very precarious moment, right? Because you have to wonder if we pissed away the 2000s, killing a lot of people in the Middle East, rather than attending to global order in a way that would have been locked in U.S. advantages more, been productive, more peaceful. Now that we've sort of started to come out of some of the overhang of that, we're seem to be pissing it away with Trumpism.
Right.
So the question is, you know, even if we could get our act together in 4, 6, or 8 years, that's not going to be in a situation where the U.S. has even the same capacity it has now, likely to tell other states what to do. So that makes the kinds of questions you raised about how do we do adjustment, how do we do cooperative adjustment, how do we work out bargains that are not going to look exactly how we want them to look, and how much can we tolerate of that? How much can we tolerate sort of the nuts and bolts of peaceful adjustment to states who do not share all of our kinds of interests and values? Those become increasingly pressing.
Right. And another thing I would add here, right? I mean, when people talk about, you know, specifically China's strategic position and the advantages that the United States has over China, they sometimes talk about alliance politics, right? Alliance politics in some of the same ways, right? And that India is really not that far behind China in a lot of ways, and India is more democratic and so forth. You know, that even if, you know, that's in the end, your strategic answer to the problem of China, which is that China can be checked. Mm-hmm. Like an offshore balancer would, by countries that are around China rather than by us, that still doesn't leave you in a situation where the U.S. has anything like the kind of advantages that it had in 1945 or even in 2000 with respect to sort of the broadly understood diplomatic and economic regulatory regime that manages global politics, right? That, you know, that is a wasting asset, and it's wasting very, very quickly right now, no matter what the strategic situation is going to look like vis-a-vis U.S. and Beijing.
And beyond that, we talk about alliance politics, and you know, one of the you know, I've argued, you would argue that the great sort of infrastructural advantage the United States has is in these kinds of alliance, multilateral, bilateral alliance and partnerships. Right? That's really where the U.S. is kind of unmatched. I've argued that's what the Russians really resent. Part of why they've been so aggressive in Syria is it's their only site of overseas basing, that kind of thing. But those systems are fairly vulnerable, right? They're more vulnerable than even a kind of imperial federacy, federation, which is China, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're easier to wedge apart. They're easier to offer selective incentives to get people to defect from them. They're easier to have tiffs within them that can be exploited or spill over. And so there's a kind of shakiness to those arrangements. They look very durable because many of them have been around for, you know, 60, 70 years. So we think of them as sort of, we take them for granted. But, you know, the Chinese and the Russians are proving more adept than we would have expected in their ability to if not wedge them apart, at least make inroads and in undermine collective decision making. And again, that's likely to kind of grow over the long run. So, you know, we can't place our bets on the... So this is, I mean, this, we talk about how unusual it is. When China's economy in nominal terms overtakes the United States, even now when it is overtaken in PPP terms, right? This is the first time there's in modern history where the most where the wealthiest country on the planet hasn't been democratic.
Great.
Right? It's the first time in history that the wealthiest country hasn't been in 150 years the wealthiest country hasn't been in the sort of North Atlantic community writ large, right?
Right.
It's the first time in 150 years that that country has also been territorially distant. The United States was territorially distant, but it's the, mm-hmm. you know, it's, right. I don't know quite how to say this, but there are a lot of things that are very unusual.
Well, and let me, I mean, and this is something actually you touched upon. I can't remember if it was on Twitter or whether it was in a post, and I think this is a question for the next podcast, which mm-hmm. we will do at a next time, but it's the first time in 500 years, 400 years, that the world's wealthiest, most powerful country has not been fundamentally white, right? Mm-hmm. Which was a major preoccupation of the way people thought about international politics in the 1930s and the 1940s, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are, and that we don't necessarily think of in the same way now, but, mm-hmm. you know, this is really world-changing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it is something that's opening up a new way of thinking about politics.
So yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of reason to suspect that the U.S. position. I mean, the general consensus is this is like our discussions about structural, structural problems in economies, right? The general way we tend to look at these things is to overestimate U.S. strengths and underestimate U.S. weaknesses and to overestimate weaknesses in other countries.
Right.
And there may even be some racism there, as you suggest, or as you've implied. And there are actually a lot of reasons to think that our position is much more precarious than we believe it is. And that, again, puts a premium on saying, you know, what can we do while that position is quite likely to be comparatively better than it is in the future, to make the international order that's going to evolve more convivial for our interests and our security.
Right.
What are we going to do to try to solidify the advantages that we think we have? You know, the sort of natural advantage, the offshore balancing advantages, the fact that we do have really deep integrated security ties with states in a way that is unprecedented. I mean, that's not the way security alliances worked 150 years ago. It seems to me that what we are in fact consumed with is domestic political struggles.
Right, and I guess that's sort of one of the answers here, right, is that we could sit here all day and think about ways in which the United States could take active steps to shore up this position and to maintain this international order. But, you know, at this point, the political structure of the United States is geared towards destroying those things rather than sort of producing good answers, right? It wants to produce the worst possible answers so that order can be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. So. I mean, ironically, and this would have looked terrible for a lot of reasons, mm-hmm. if the Bannonite program of reorienting the Republican Party, although it was... I mean, the technical aspects of what they were talking about were kind of stupid, right? Just throw money at everything, et cetera,
right?
Just overprime the pump, you know. But nonetheless, if those policies had won the day, right, if you'd had a more kind of conventional right-wing populism, right, one mm-hmm. that was really a right-wing greatness project in policy terms, not just rhetorically, you could have very easily seen fairly strong coalitions centered around, essentially, measures of protectionism would have been a different matter, but centered, mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of its consequences, but centered around, you know, big investments,
right.
Sort of hegemony promoting activities, although, again, foreign policy implications of this might have been quite different. But then at least you would have taken off the table the kind of relentless tax cutting right, and relentless kind of Pensian deregulation that's really quite destructive, right? So the Republican Party remains locked in a myth that this is somehow going to build U.S. greatness, when in fact the empirical evidence is exactly the opposite.
Right. It's that if anything, the opposite. Mm-hmm. Right.
But we can't even get alignment on that, right? So you know, our choices are essentially kind of left wing butter, right, and right wing tax cuts, and then it's not And I'm actually think we need butter.
Butter's great.
I mean, I think actually the irony here is that the very steps we would take to combat inequality are precisely the steps we would take if we cared about American greatness. Nonetheless, so I just don't know. And as you say, we were complacent about the Chinese. We've been very complacent about the ability of the U.S. Domestic system to handle shocks, and I think that what we're learning is that the period of functionality, right, in which was less functional than we remember, mm-hmm. but the period we have nostalgia for as being functional at the national level, 50s, 60s, even comparatively the 70s and the 80s, the post sort of mm-hmm. Which we thought at the time things were falling apart in the 70s, nonetheless, right.
Hold my beer. 70s.
That may have been the unusual period, right?
Right.
Before reversion to the form of the 19th century, which was completely dysfunctional.
Well, I think with this we have to let our listeners off and say this is it. I mean, not that we're not going to return to these subjects in the future, but mm-hmm. I think this has probably been enough for right now.
And, indeed, this is the end of part two of a two-part episode on U.S. policy and the rise of China. Hope you enjoyed it.